Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Today, we're going to be exploring the role of different foods in our well-being, always from quality science, but ways that we can take something seemingly complicated and make it very easy for everyone. We should never forget, no matter how long we've been practicing good health habits, and many of you have for a long time, there are those who are just beginning their journey. And hence, we must always keep them in the loop. We have to share information at a level of awareness with examples that they can say, I understand it. I know how to apply that. That seems reasonable. And also, we have a lot of scientists, nurses, physicians, people within the health field who listen. And one of the reasons that they listen and frequently use this material is because they know that it is all qualified, meaning if I'm going to share a particular topic, I'm going to give you the references. There's a level of scholarship that's applied to everything we do here, as you'll see today. For example, when we talk about fruits and vegetables, aren't only good for a healthy body, but they also protect your mind. That'll be from a study published in the British Medical Journal and from the University of Los Palmos in Canaria in Spain, a major study with 15,000 people. Over a long period of time, and they found out that the more fruits and vegetables they ate, it was not only helping them with their body, but also helped their mind. And it's simple enough to understand that, because we know that the omega-3 fatty acids, vitamins and minerals, antioxidants, are all good to help your brain function better, your neurons, and turn off inflammation. And that inflammation ultimately leads to Alzheimer's, dementia, memory loss, all forms of conditions. But mind you, and here's what this audience understands that others may not or fully appreciate. When you have taken in something, let's say you've eaten a French fry or a piece of pizza, and today a new study came out showing 1/3 of all the meals eaten by young people in the United States are eaten in fast food restaurants or brought into the home as fast food in the home. And now we know that those are extremely inflammatory, meaning they turn on inflammation. But it's not just inflammation in your muscles. Let's say you end up eating a food and your muscles swell. That's where you're most susceptible. But that inflammatory agent, that cytokine, that'll go throughout your blood in about 6 to 7 minutes to every cell in your body. So it is also damaging your kidneys and your liver and your pancreas and your brain. It's just that every single part of our body ages at a different level. For example, this morning I was in getting some juice before I start my day, and I always get a gallon of juice, of different types of juices, and little cups of, let's say today I got cups of radishes, sweet onions, and some avocado, and I poured lemon juice over it and some seasonings. Now throughout the day I'll graze on that, have little bits of it, and that way I keep to only one meal a day. And generally that's after my show in the early afternoon. And then the rest of the day, just grazing. Nice big protein shake in the morning with all the different nutrients in it. And then a couple more times a day, because your body needs protein, fats, and fiber at least 3 to 5 times a day. So small amounts of food on a regular basis is the right way to consume. What I call living food program. The foods are, if they're heated, they're not heated to high enough temperature to destroy their nutrients, but make them more bioavailable and easier to digest, like broccoli, cauliflower, asparagus, Brussels sprouts. You eat those raw, you're not going to digest them. They're going to go through your system undigested. Flaxseed. I drink the flaxseed oil because if you eat the flaxseed, 90% of it's going to go right through you, not be digested. So we have to understand it's the bioavailability, meaning how much of the actual nutrients in an item will your body actually be able to absorb and use. And that's why taking a nut butter, where they take the nuts and they pulverize them, is much more beneficial than just eating nuts. Now, you can eat nuts if you've got a really good digestive system. Great. They'll be absorbed, but not at 100%, maybe 80%. Whereas the nut butters, the raw organic nut butters and seed butters, sesame seeds, pumpkin seeds, chia seed, sunflower seeds, those seeds are best eaten as a butter, raw organic butter, and preferably something is handcrafted, meaning it comes from a smaller company. And I like to support smaller companies. I have nothing against a big company doing it, but I know that a small handcrafted company, someone's actually in that kitchen, actually doing that with their own hands. They don't have all the machines. It's not automated. It's them. And there's always something nice knowing that something's been handcrafted. Like I'd rather buy my soap knowing that it's handcrafted than buy soap that comes out of, you know, a dispenser from a multi, you know, million container making company. Anyhow, so for those of you just tuning on, and it looks like somewhere around 2.5 million people have visited us just in the near future, just recently, and most of those are newer people, so we welcome you. Now, today we're going to have a guest in the second part of our program. He is Professor David Vine. And Professor Vine, highly respected in his field, he is Professor of Anthropology, American University in Washington, D.C. And we're going to talk about something that was not discussed with any sense of reasonableness in the presidential debates. We're going to talk about the U.S. military presence and expansion around the globe. It's actually making us less safe. It threatens our security. It causes unnecessary suffering on the people in those countries who are indiscriminately killed or displaced. We're going to deal with that. Also today, I'm going to share a comment from Stanley Heller from Truthdig. It's time to break with Saudi Arabia's kingdom of horrors. And yet the President of the United States, with all the pomp and pageantry imaginable, recently had a meeting with the King of Saudi Arabia, King Salman. Wait till you hear what happened. And I'm going to juxtapose that to what Saudi Arabia is causing in their immense slaughtering campaign, their absolutely ravaging campaign in Yemen. So I'll compare the two. Not a word about the suffering of others because of our military exceptionalism. We're going to deal with that. Also, recession continues for a record number of homeless students. Nadia Prupas on that, and a whole lot more. So let's begin. I believe that we would be better off having our fruits and vegetables in four forms on a daily basis. And the more you have, the healthier it is, especially if you're having variety. For example, fresh, organic, locally grown. And if you go to the farmer's market, your local food co-ops, or small health food stores, you can get those. Better still, grow them yourselves. And I will be, starting in 2 months, I'm going to do a once a day for a week video workshop where I'm going to build from scratch a backyard hydroponic project. And each day, for an hour, I'll show you, starting with an average backyard, how to do it, how inexpensive it is, how much you can grow, and how the weather is really irrelevant. It doesn't matter whether it's cold or hot. You're going to stay consistent because of the medium that you're growing it in, and no insects, and organic. And you can supply all your needs for all your vegetables and microgreens and sprouts for an entire year for pennies a day. So in the interim, get a lot of greens, microgreens, which are just mini little vegetables, and like salad greens, like arugula and basil and bib lettuce, when they're maybe 3 weeks old rather than 2 months old. When they're 2 months, they're fully grown, but they actually have more nutrients when they're smaller. So have those. Then juice them. Remember, 97 to 98% of all juice is water. So if you eliminate the water, then you're getting the concentrate of what was most powerful and important in the vegetable or the fruit. So you got three ways right off the bat: fresh, then juiced which is great for you because you're getting 100% digestion, and you're getting it diluted, and you're getting it to where it's cleansing up bacteria and viruses in your intestine, killing the bad bacteria, but helping the good bacteria to grow, and spiking that with some probiotics of 4 to 5 billion a day would be terrific for you. But if you have candida, if you've had cancer, immune defects, you'll want to do that 3 times a day. And if you've had, if you have cancer, you should be juicing at least 10 glasses to 13 glasses of juice a day. That takes me back to when I was getting my juice, and this fellow comes over and he says that, he's living with a melanoma and he's having a glass of juice. And he said it's comes in and out of remission. And he said, do you have anything that can help? And I said, well, what is your goal? What is your objective? He said, well, to no longer have cancer. I said, okay, on a scale of 1 to 100, what are you willing to commit as far as change to get there? And he said, well, I'm willing to change. And I said, all right. Are you willing to go strictly vegan? Are you willing to juice? Are you willing to give up? And he said, hold on a second. I love vodka. Do I have to give that up? I said, yes. He said, why? I said, because vodka kills about 3 million cells with each drink. He said, you're kidding. I said, no, it causes inflammation in every area of the body, and especially with the pancreas. So anyone who is pre-diabetic or diabetic should never drink alcohol, even beer. It can really play havoc. Also, you're killing off the very cells, your immune cells, and adversely affecting the B cells in your bone marrow and your thymus gland and your T cells. That's what keeps you from having cancer in the first place. So in effect, just imagine that you're destroying what is guarding your body with every glass of vodka. He says, well, then I got to think about this. So imagine on one side of the equation is looking at death, and the other is looking at health, but you have to make sacrifices and go through some discomfort. What is the percentage of people that are willing to make that journey of surrendering what is unhealthy, even if they love it, and embracing something they may not like, and have to readapt new adaptive taste to do something good? Therein is the effort. And I said, well, if you want to change, just let me know and I'll help you change. So then you have your juices, you have your concentrates, your powders, which are the most powerful of all because you're getting the most of the actual biological nutrients, the most antioxidants, the most phytochemicals, the most of the polyphenols, and all of the healing agents are the highest concentration in your powders. And the future, I believe, will be powders. I believe that powders and juices will be it for a lot of people because the prices will be reasonable and they'll be available, and that'll be the more educated people are, that's where they're going. In any case, those are the things you do. And according to this study from published in the British Medical Journal from Canarias, Spain, that's why we should have a healthy body and healthy brain. Remember, anything that helps keep your body healthy is keeping your brain healthy. Like it or not, it's doing that. Then next up, we want to take a look at being overweight. University of Regensburg's in Germany show that being overweight just by itself, with nothing else, increases your risk of a type of brain tumor. This was published by the American Academy of Neurology. And these are called meningiomas. And they occur at about 8 cases per 100,000 people per year. That's a pretty high number. Quote, this is an important finding since there are few known risk factors for meningioma, and the ones we do know about are not things a person can change. And there was a meta-analysis to show this. Well, hello, 12 separate studies show that the more overweight you are, the greater the incidence. Also, gliomas increase tremendously when you're overweight, another brain cancer. So here's the takeaway message. By being overweight, for whatever reason you are overweight, you are increasing your risk of brain cancer. Also, for those of you who wondered why in the evening do you have a hard time falling asleep, one of the reasons is caffeine. Now, caffeine's not just in coffee or espressos in huge amounts, but it's a lot of the energy drinks. In fact, it's most of the energy drinks, and it's in most of the herbal teas. Even a good healthy tea that has, let's say, 90 milligrams of caffeine is enough to keep you up at night, so you want to have those earlier in the day. And there's a major study done at the University of Colorado in Boulder shows that caffeine in the evening can delay our circadian clocks that tell us when we're ready for sleep and ready for awakening. So if you don't want your circadian clock turned off, then you better stay away from any caffeine within 4 hours of going to bed. Because once that clock has been interfered with, you can stay awake for hours. And this was published in Science Translational Medicine. If you want a simple herb, one you could grow yourself, it's basil. And there's also holy basil. And basil is part of the mint family. And you've probably are familiar with sweet basil, which is the form commonly used in Italian cuisine. I also happen to like lemon basil, cinnamon basil, and lime basil. So there's a whole lot of different basils. And the most important is the original basil called Thai basil, T-H-A-I, and it plays an important role in Ayurvedic medicine. Ayurvedic is the old Indian medicine that's been used for thousands of years. In the West, we like it because of its taste. But in other countries, they like it because of its therapeutic value. The importance of this basil, it is considered an herbal medicine as a longevity herb. And it targets a whole lot of health problems that you have. So it's called an adaptogenic herb, meaning it, like ginseng and ginkgo, it helps our body adapt. Adapt to stress, adapt to any form of stress. It improves forgetfulness. It helps you if you have sexual difficulties, if you're fatigued, if you have sleep problems. It helps you with all these things. It's an immunostimulatory herb. It helps your immune system. It turns off inflammation in the body, much like aspirin. In fact, there was a study published in the peer-reviewed literature that showed that basil lowered cortisol, a hormone that increases in response to stress. And it has anthocyanins, antho, A-N-T-H-O, cy, C-Y-A, nins, N-I-N-S. That's the purple pigment in grapes and plums and sweet peppers. It's been shown to have very protective DNA qualities, meaning it actually protects your cells from damage. It lowers your blood sugar. So anyone who has a tendency to prediabetes or diabetes should be using basil. It helps fight cancer. In fact, it has strong anti-carcinogenic properties, especially for the prostate. It helps men and pancreatic cancer, and it helps with antimicrobial properties. It's very good at killing bacteria, E. coli, Staphylococcus aureus, and Candida albicans, the fungus that often spreads in the body following the use of antibiotics. It promotes longevity. And so that's our herb of the day. And also today, I want to mention from the University Medical Center in the Netherlands, the omega-3, there's your walnuts and avocados and flaxseed or fish if you don't use those. It helps kids who have ADHD. Quote from the study. A daily dose of omega-3, meaning DHA and EPA, can improve attention in kids with and without attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And 16 weeks of consuming 650 milligrams a day, which is not a lot, made this improvement. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Neuropsychopharmacology. So if you want to have a child have better attention, be calmer, be more focused, give them some omega-3 fatty acids each day. And finally, from Sayer G of GreenMed Info, how eating kimchi, Kim, K-I-M, Chi, C-H-I, it prevents lethal cancer. And kimchi is one of the world's most popular fermented foods. And a new study published in the journal OncoTarget entitled Dietary Prevention of Helicobacter Pylori-Associated Gastric Cancer with Kimchi is just the latest example of how a simple dietary intervention can make a world of difference in reducing the risk of one of the most lethal cancers. Gastric or stomach cancer is the third leading cause of death from cancer, meaning all cancers. And so by taking this in, and what is kimchi? Well, I don't like it, so I'll eat other fermented cabbage juice dishes. But it's mainly cabbage, but they also add in a lot of spices. But it's how they ferment it. And in this case, it protects the membrane of the stomach, the mucosa, turns off inflammation. And that's important. So if you don't mind kimchi, it tastes great. If you do, then sauerkraut. And if you have ulcers, a stomach cancer, colon cancer, then cabbage juice, raw, organic, fermented cabbage juice, 3 times a day, makes a tremendous difference. It reduces interleukin-6, a chemical messenger associated with increasing inflammation. It reduces STAT3 activation, which has been linked to cancer. It reduces PGE2, which is a prostaglandin, linked to inflammation. It increases HO1 and HSP70, a direct indirect markers for improved oxidative stress. And it does all these great things in your body. All right? So that's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break and come right back at you. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from around the world. I'm Gary Nall. By the way, you can listen in North America to this program by calling a phone number at noon Eastern Standard Time or any time between noon and 1. And that number, write it down, 712-432-7231, 712-432-7231. I'm going to get us some numbers next week, but I was told, without full confirmation, that we're approaching 20 million minutes listened. We're number one in North America and Canada, and I think we're in the top 5 in the entire world of all the thousands of stations using it. So we realize people are listening on the go, especially young people, and so that's why we have this, what we have for you. Now, we're going to play a little clip for you here that I thought you would enjoy before we go to our guest. And we're going to go to our guest in about 10 minutes from now. And it's all about the policing for profit, the abuse of civil asset forfeiture. I was going to play it yesterday, but we didn't have time. So let's listen in now. This is short, but very relevant to those of us who are concerned about the erosion of our constitutional rights and liberties, America becoming militarized. In effect, we become a police state. Please listen in.
If police suspect that you committed a crime, they can arrest you and put you on trial. At that trial, prosecutors must prove you are guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But if police suspect your car was involved in a crime, they can take it, sell it, and in most places, pocket the proceeds to pad their budgets. They need not prove you committed any crime or even arrest you to take your property away. Welcome to the upside-down world of civil asset forfeiture. With civil forfeiture, your property is guilty until you prove it innocent to get it back. And because most state and federal laws allow police and prosecutors to pocket the proceeds, they have a big incentive to pursue profits, not justice. How big? In 1986, the Justice Department's forfeiture fund took in $94 million. Now, it has more than a billion. State and local agencies receive forfeiture funds too. But we don't know how much because most states don't publicly report on forfeiture. No surprise, abuse is rampant. One New York police department spent forfeiture funds on food, gifts, and entertainment. In Georgia, forfeiture funds paid for football tickets for a DA's office. And a DA in Texas used forfeiture dollars to buy TV ads for his re-election campaign. Meanwhile, citizens are seeing cash, cars, and other property taken away for the flimsiest of reasons. Carrying too much cash? Police can accuse you of selling drugs or laundering money and seize it. No conviction or even arrest required. An Institute for Justice study grades state laws on how well they protect people from wrongful forfeitures. Only three states receive a B or better. The rest range from mediocre to awful. And so does federal law. Worse, a federal legal loophole allows police and prosecutors to bypass state protections and keep pocketing forfeiture money. IJ's research shows that the easier and more profitable these laws make forfeiture, the more it is used and abused. It's time to end civil forfeiture. People shouldn't have their property taken away without being convicted of a crime. And law enforcement shouldn't be policing for profit.
But they are. And that amount is now up to $4 billion a year. In fact, it's so bad in some states, like North Carolina, South Carolina, Louisiana, southern states, that if a cop likes the way your car looks, let's say you have a unique car, they can confiscate that car. It becomes their car. And they've even taken over people's businesses. Now, mind you, we're not talking about people who've broken the law. We're talking about where no law has been broken. I just think it's wrong. Something else I think is wrong is not knowing enough about the way that we give our monies to charity and the assumption that that charity is doing everything in our best interest. For example, the World Wildlife Fund. Now, granted, it has done a lot of good work, and I commend them for their work over the years since 1961 in being able to inform us about animal welfare issues across the globe. However, they're one of the most powerful charities in the world. And like the Susan G. Komen Foundation that I wouldn't give a penny to, it's a foundation that also chooses some extreme partners in which to share on its policies. The latest is the World Life Fund and Monsanto connecting together. And with its signature panda logo and history of doing good work on behalf of animal welfare, the World Wildlife Fund for Nature has become an easily recognized charity. And according to this study by Nick Myers of Alternative Health Works, it's changed. Now, most people don't see documentaries, unfortunately, but there is a good documentary that exposes this called Panda Leaks, the dark side of the World Wildlife Fund, and The Silence of the Panda from the documentarian, the German filmmaker, Wilfried Husmann. And the book became a big bestseller when it hit the stores about 2012. and terrified of all the allegations between linking them to everything from commando hit squads in Africa to promoting Monsanto's GMO crops, the World Wildlife Fund managed to stop the sale of the book for several weeks due to a massive campaign. And a series of lawsuits followed, but they were ultimately unable to prevent Huseman's controversial book from being released. Now, contained within the book is a cavalcade of secrets, including the World Wildlife Fund's relationship with Monsanto. And they took money, lots of money, from Monsanto, according to one German newspaper. As stated on the website GM Watch, the friendly panda logo-clad charity, the World Wildlife Fund, actually collaborated with Monsanto to create something called the Roundtable on Responsible Soy. Really? The campaign has been criticized as being a covert exercise in Monsanto's patented brand of greenwashing, which calls GMO soy a responsible choice for protecting the environment, despite much independent evidence to the contrary. In other words, the countless people across the world who donate $20 or more per month to the World Wildlife Fund are actually funding a charity that ties to what many call the most evil corporation in the world. And there's a whole lot of independent science showing that the GMO soy is a grave threat to the Amazon rainforest. Now, you've got two major rainforests that are affected in South America, Brazil and Argentina, and they're hotbeds of soy production, with most of it being grown with genetically modified seeds from Monsanto and other companies. And the native Amazon rainforest and other lands have suffered at the hands of GMO soy boom. Between 2007 and 2008, 3 million acres of the Brazilian Amazon rainforest was destroyed because of illegal logging, soy plantations, and cattle ranching. So not an association should exist. So I would suggest, I don't tell people where they put their money, but think well and let the World Wildlife Fund know that the kind of association they have, especially with Monsanto, is not healthy. Also, very important is several other issues involving. One is, and I'm going to get to this GlaxoSmithKline because I think it's important. Why? Because GlaxoSmithKline was fined $488.8 million for a massive, quote, bribery network with doctors. That's a conspiracy, a massive conspiracy. First, shame on the doctors. Could you imagine if the 920,000-plus doctors in America decided to actually no longer practice medicine if it was in any way shown to be harmful or non-productive to the patient? You would radically change 90% of all medical practice. Secondly, what if they went on strike to have universal health care so that no one, no matter how poor, was not given proper medical care? But the trouble is, even when you're insured, the quality of the medicine itself is proprietary medicine. Hence, it's all about making profit, whether it's the hospitals, doctors, the pharmaceutical companies. Everybody's in it for the money because we're getting sicker and sicker. So we're not really helping the people except for emergency medicine. So then on top of that, you end up with a company that is respected in Washington, that is loved by Wall Street, that has access to the White House, that can participate in its lobbying activities, that supports the Trans-Pacific Partnership and ALEX, and China fined the British pharmaceutical company $488.8 million, that's 3 billion yuan, quote, for a massive bribery network, get doctors and hospitals to use its products. And 5 former employees were sentenced to 2 to 4 years in jail, but ordered deported instead of imprisoned. So just remember, when you see the companies out there that are making the billions of dollars in profits, they're doing it unethically or illegally. And finally, we've been led to believe that, gee whiz, we wake up one day and we have something called global warming. Wow, if only we would have known. We could have done something about it. With all of our capacity to make great changes, we could have changed. Here's the catch. According to a special report on Inside Climate News by Needs Banjiri, Lisa Song, and David Hassemeyer, Exxon's own research confirmed fossil fuels' role in global warming decades ago, meaning top executives were warned of possible catastrophic greenhouse effects. that if they didn't change. Now, let's get to the actual heart of this. At a meeting in Exxon Corporation's headquarters, a senior scientist named James F. Black addressed an audience of powerful oilmen. Speaking without a text, as he flipped through detailed slides, Black delivered a sobering message that carbon dioxide from the world's use of fossil fuels would warm the planet and could eventually endanger humanity. But it gets worse. Quote, in the first place, there's a general scientific agreement that the most likely manner in which mankind is influencing global climate is through carbon dioxide released from the burning of fossil fuels, is what he told. And he was, Black told Exxon's management committee. Then it was in July 1977 when Exxon's leaders received this blunt assessment well before most of the world had even heard of a climate crisis. A year later, Black, a top technical expert in Exxon's research and engineering division, took an updated version of his presentation to a broader audience. He warned Exxon scientists and managers that independent researchers estimated a doubling of the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere would increase average global temperatures by 2 to 3 degrees Celsius. By the way, that's 4 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit. And as much as 10 degrees Celsius, that's 18 degrees Fahrenheit, at the poles, North Pole and South Poles. Rainfall might get heavier in some regions and other places turn to desert. Quote, some countries would benefit, but others would have their agriculture output reduced or destroyed. That's what he wrote in his summary in 1978. So, when we're told about, gee whiz, if only we would have known, the industry, its top executives, all knew. Its scientists knew. This was shared by everyone. And if you don't think that's bad, let me tell you the latest. This is from Emily J. Gertz from TakePart.com. It's a scenario straight out of the X-Files. A prehistoric pathogen isolated for thousands of years in the Arctic ice comes to light in modern world. The catch is it's not science fiction. And thanks to the great Arctic thaw that's been going on for the last 20 years, the discoveries suggest an emerging public health worry. And why? Because French scientists announced this week that working in the lab, they have found a, quote, giant virus in a 30,000-year-old sample of permafrost from Siberia. This is the second giant virus isolated from the same permafrost sample in 2 years. The team found each one by infecting a common contemporary protozoan with viral material from the sample. Quote, the fact that the two different viruses retain their infectivity in prehistoric permafrost layers should be of concern in the context of global warming. And that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Quote, if we're not careful and we industrialize these areas without putting safeguards in place, we run the risk of one day waking up viruses such as smallpox that we thought were eradicated and a few viral particles that are still infectious may be enough in the presence of a vulnerable host to revive potentially pathogenic viruses. So the takeaway message is here. We have these huge viruses that have been discovered, and they're alive once they were thawed after 30 years of being frozen. Now, mind you, all of the tundras and permafrosts are thawing. Imagine not just methane, but imagine the viruses and bacteria that were kept in there that are going to come into contact with people. So, one more reason why we should be extremely careful and not be in there drilling for natural resources, because then you create trucks and roads and people and encampments and cities, and that's all it takes. I'm Gary Nall. Also, for the people who knew Dr. Mitchell Gaynor, in my opinion, one of the finest holistic oncologists in America, he just passed. And don't know, I've heard different reports. I'm going to wait to see that I get something that's accurate, but he's no longer with us. and the Sprout man, Steve Meyerowitz, who I knew very well. In fact, help him get his start by bringing him on my radio show. If you remember way back, I had him on the show, 40 years ago, a lot. And Steve was always a nice guy, always a good educator, and a great example of just a healthy, happy human being. I understand that he passed in a car accident up in Maine. I'll get more details on it. Two wonderful people from the health field that are gone now. Now, let's go over and say hello to Professor David Vine, V-I-N-E. He's in Washington, D.C. He is an associate professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C., where his research focuses on U.S. foreign and military policy, militarization, human rights, race and ethnicity, and other related topics. He's also a steering member of the Network of Concerned Anthropologists, which publishes a text he co-authored, The Counterinsurgency Manual, or Notes on Demilitarizing American Society. And his website is davidvine.net. Nice to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I don't know if you had a chance to watch any of the GOP debate, nor were willing to put yourself through that kind of torture. But I can't recall when I last heard so many candidates in a single gathering, except for one, Rand Paul, praise U.S. militarism around the globe and the U.S.'s preeminent role in to sustain peace through weapons. And of course, there were the shots taken at Islamic militant organizations, Iran, China, Russia, Yemen, and almost unanimous support for Bush's invasion of Iraq. And I feel it is accurate to state that without U.S. military presence encircling the planet, the U.S. would never have reached its economic heights in the past, nor continue to hold its shaky status as the leading economic power without U.S. military expansion. And the GOP candidates would have us believe, and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, they're both on board on this, that the 800-plus known, and likely far more than that, shadow military installations in at least 80 countries are essential for U.S. national security. Then at least there is U.S. military presence, not in strict military installations, in an additional 80 countries. And as you've noted in your writings, some are the size of cities, such as Okinawa and in Germany. So clearly, you don't have this kind of militarist presence without an underlying ambition towards empire building. And when voters go to the polls in November, they're going to vote with the false belief that our militarist domination of the planet is essential for maintaining America's standard of living, setting aside for the moment the reality of how much of American quality of life has eroded in the past 15 years. And they will vote with the belief that their lives are much safer with a $610 billion defense budget. That does not include an additional $600 billion in other spendings involved in the same field. So before I ask you to turn the tables on this mythology that U.S. militarist domination around the world makes us safer, please first summarize for us the scope of U.S. military bases, the wide variety of personnel, military and civilian, the types of bases there are, and the kinds of facilities our tax dollars are purchasing, and how does this compare to other countries' military presence in foreign countries, and particularly those countries that the U.S. government and our political parties call our enemies?
Well, a tall order, but let me see what I can do. I think you began rightly by pointing out that we have some 800 military bases outside the United States. That's outside the 50 states and Washington, D.C., and that number comes is based on a number that the Pentagon puts together on a yearly basis. It creates a list of bases worldwide, and its last count, there were 686 base sites outside the 50 states and D.C., but their list excludes many well-known bases, like bases in Kuwait, as well as secret and secretive bases. And so after studying the issue for now 14 years or more, my best estimate is that we have around 800 military bases outside the 50 states and D.C. And as you pointed out, that is likely an undercount. It's definitely a conservative estimate. And these bases do range in size from, as you said, city-sized bases like you see in Okinawa or Germany, Italy, South Korea, to much smaller bases, some increasingly popular brand of bases, if you will, called lily pad bases or cooperative security locations. And these have popped up around the world in the past decade or two and been increasingly popular for military leaders and some neoconservative and other analysts. And they're popping up in places where the United States hasn't had a military presence either ever or perhaps since World War II, so parts of Africa, places that most people in the United States would never know we have a military presence, places like Burkina Faso, where there happens to have been a coup in the past 24 hours or so, Kenya, Ethiopia, also places in Central and Eastern Europe, as well as Asia. So you see a wide variety of bases. The lily pad bases often host drones, special forces operatives, and are secretive almost by definition and are an attempt to conceal a U.S. military presence in most cases, or at least to avoid the kind of opposition and protests we've seen with some of the much larger bases like those in Okinawa, for example. And comparing our collection of bases to other countries, the rest of the world combined has about 30 foreign bases among them. So this is Britain, France, Russia, and a few other countries. There's some signs that China might be interested in creating its first foreign base, its first extraterritorial base. So compared to our collection of around 800, we possess about 95% of the world's foreign bases. And certainly in the past and probably to the present, we have more foreign bases than any people, nation, or empire in world history. It's really an unprecedented collection of bases. And I referenced the past because the collection of bases was larger in the past during World War II, during the Cold War, and even in the past decade, of course, when we were occupying Iraq and Afghanistan at the height of the occupations, we probably had somewhere close to 2,000. In Afghanistan and Iraq alone, there were around 1,000 U.S. bases. But it's important to point out that while the collection of U.S. bases overseas has shrunk in recent years, it's about half the size, at least in number, compared to the end of the Cold War when we had about 1,600. The scope, the breadth, is actually expanded. So while at the end of the Cold War, we were in 40 foreign nations, we're in about 80 right now. So while the sheer number has declined, the scope and the breadth of the presence has increased. And I think in ways that most people in the United States are totally unaware of and are unaware of the potential consequences of having such a broad military presence that may be getting us involved in conflicts and inflaming conflicts, for that matter, in parts of the world that we know little about.
I want to deal with something specific that concerns our military presence or supporting others with intelligence, satellite, reconnaissance, drones, and that is Saudi Arabia. And according to Stanley Heller from Truthdig, that the Saudi King Salman met recently in Washington, D.C., and instead of having a normal 10-vehicle motorcade, he considered that insulting, so he rented 400 black Mercedes S-Class automobiles to make it bigger, and they didn't even have any place to put them. They had to put them at the Joint Base Andrews in Maryland. And also, what they are responsible, Saudi Arabia is personally responsible for the massive devastation and death, starvation and displacement in Yemen, and where the monumental vanity of the Saudi regime caused it to interfere and invade, and conditions are really bad. You have almost 10 million children in need of urgent humanitarian assistance. That's according to UNICEF. Now, 10 million children is an abstraction. It's hard to understand. Instead, think of one child crying all night in pain or hunger. Now multiply that sound 10,000 times. And what a collection of supposed heroes that they kept bragging about in their debate. The Saudis have gathered to make a war on Yemen. It includes Persian Gulf monarchs whose construction domestic work is done under conditions of near slavery, and the Egyptian dictator who holds the one-day record for slaughter at a sit-in, and the Sudanese president who travel options are limited because he's under indictment for genocide and crimes against humanity, think Darfur. Let's not leave out the United States president who has a kill notches on his Nobel Peace Prize for missions ranging from Libya to Pakistan and Afghanistan and other places. And so here are presidents meeting. Here are all these presidential people, left and right, Democrat and Republican, all agreeing Saudi Arabia is great, the people in these countries are great, and they're not. Show us the consequences of being with these people and causing so much destruction.
No, I think that's exactly right, and it's one of the most disturbing aspects of this huge collection of bases overseas, again, that very few people in the United States know anything about. I knew nothing about it, practically, before I started studying it 14 years ago. But what you see is, unfortunately, a clear preference on the part of the military for maintaining bases in fundamentally undemocratic countries, in countries that are led by dictators and other repressive regimes. And the Persian Gulf is case in point. The United States now has bases in every Persian Gulf nation except Iran. And that this is one of the parts of the globe where we've seen a very significant expansion in both the size of U.S. bases and the breadth of U.S. bases and the sheer number in the past really 30 years since the enunciation of the Carter Doctrine in 1979 and 1980. So what we see is these bases are de facto supporting repressive regimes. Bahrain, of course, is one of the most egregious examples, where the Bahraini government cracked down brutally, violently, leading the deaths and torture of unknown numbers as a pro-democracy movement sprung up there. Meanwhile, the Obama administration was largely silent in the face of that, because Bahrain hosts a major U.S. naval base for the entire Middle East. And we see this throughout the region and beyond, Thailand, Chad, and beyond. U.S. bases have propped up dictators, and while U.S. leaders have frequently said these bases, spread democracy and are an image and model for the world, so, well, there might have been some truth to that after World War II with bases in Germany and Japan, that is long since the case. Bases all too often are actually actively helping to repress pro-democracy movements and repress the spread of democracy worldwide.
Final question. You've traveled extensively and visited foreign countries where some of our largest military bases and operations are located. And you came to the conclusion that the doctrine of safety through military expansion around the globe is illusory. Instead, this massive expansion is likely contributing to the very opposite of what the majority of our politicians and Americans believe. Therefore, how is it making us less safe, jeopardizing American diplomacy, credibility, and democratic posturing, and actually endangering the security of the American population?
Yeah, you would think that more bases would make us more secure, and that's basically been the assumption for now 70 years or more. This is a strategy that dates to World War II, when the United States' collection of overseas bases really exploded in size. Dates to World War II and the early days of the Cold War, when many of these bases were built or expanded in the face-off with the Soviet Union. And this basic infrastructure of overseas bases has remained in place, and people have just assumed and taken it for granted that this huge collection of bases and hundreds of thousands of troops overseas is absolutely necessary to the security of the United States and the security of the globe. But basically, no one has been challenged on that statement, on that assumption. Very few people have forced supporters of this, what I would say, very much outdated strategy to defend their claims. And so what I've found in my 14 years of research is that these bases are, in a range of ways, harming people in the United States and harming people around the globe. In the United States, we have to begin with the costs. These bases, by my very conservative estimate, are costing us around $85 billion a year. That's $85 billion a year to maintain bases and troops overseas. And that doesn't include bases and troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, where we still have bases and troops. And if you include that, the total runs to around $156 billion and likely much higher because of the conservative nature of the estimates. And I think we need to think about what these billions could be doing in the United States. We have this very robust infrastructure of bases overseas, and meanwhile, as you pointed out, our infrastructure at home in so many ways has been crumbling. Our transportation infrastructure, schools.
We're out of time, but I certainly agree with your principle. The book is called Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America. The website is davidvine.net. Thank you very much for being with us today, Professor David Vine. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.